Welcome to Hub History, the show that brings you fascinating stories from Boston history. This is episode 19, A Tale of Two Hermits. Hi, I'm Jake.
And I'm Nikki. This week, we're going to take a look at two people who chose to live as hermits in and around Boston. When you think of a hermit, your mental image is probably a monk or an aging eccentric in a cabin in the woods. But our subjects this week sought out that sort of solitary existence among the hustle and bustle of the growing city of Boston in the late 19th and early 20th century. James Gately was known as the Hermit of Hyde Park, and Anne Windsor Sherwin was the Hermit of Boston Harbor. But before we talk about these two, it's time to take a look at what's coming up this week in Boston history.
Monday is March 6th, and on March 6th, 1776, the occupying British decided that they had to give up and abandon the occupation of Boston. After the Continentals had taken over Dorchester Heights, the British planned an amphibious assault to drive them back out. But that night, a strong wind prevented the attack. The next day, the Continental position was just too strong to risk the attack. Lieutenant John Barker of the King's Own Regiment recorded the decision in his diary. March 6th. It was determined by a council of war to quit the town. Orders were given to get ready with all expedition and to take as little baggage as possible. Transports allotted for the troops, the townspeople had the liberty to go or stay. Artillery, ammunition, stores, etc., getting on board. We'll have a link to Lieutenant Barker's diary entry in the show notes this week at hubhistory.com/019.
You may recall from our episodes about the Fugitive Slave Act that Massachusetts Senator Daniel Webster staked his political career on the 1850 Compromise. The turning point in his career came with a 2.5-hour speech he gave in 1850 that's now known as the 7th of March speech. He started out, "Mr. President, I wish to speak today not as a Massachusetts man, nor as a Northern man, but as an American and a member of the Senate of the United States. I speak for the preservation of the Union. Hear me for my cause." And then he argued that there was no way to roll back slavery where it already existed, that slaveholders should have their right to own human property protected, and that America thus needed a stronger fugitive slave law. This did not endear him to his constituents back home. As Massachusetts adopted a more radical abolitionist attitude, Webster's support for the Fugitive Slave Act as a way to preserve the Union doomed his career. He was replaced by abolitionist Charles Sumner in 1851.
Wednesday is March 8th. Despite the platitudes we all learned in elementary school, the early Puritan settlers of Massachusetts didn't come here in order to spread religious freedom. They came to set up a Puritan theocracy, and they were often incredibly intolerant of dissenting beliefs. On March 8th, 1680, Boston's Puritan authorities nailed shut the doors of the Baptist Church in the North End. The congregation had been formed in 1665, despite ongoing controversy that saw some Baptist leaders imprisoned and others banished from the colony. They secretly built a church building, and they publicly occupied it in February of 1679. That May, the legislature passed a retroactive law that banned any new churches that weren't licensed by a county court. The Baptists continued to worship in defiance of this law, and on March 8, 1680, with authorization by the legislature, the doors to their church were nailed shut. That Sunday, they worshiped in their churchyard, and the next Sunday in a nearby shed. 2 weeks later, the authorities relented, and the doors were opened again. Massachusetts gradually became more accepting of religious minorities in the late 17th and early 18th centuries, but the Congregational Church continued to be the established state religion until 1833. We'll have a link to an essay about this incident in the show notes this week at hubhistory.com/019.
In 1839, a schooner was bound for Cuba with a group of 53 newly kidnapped African slaves. They had been illegally taken into slavery in violation of international treaties, and they were being illegally shipped to a plantation in the Spanish Caribbean. Along the way, the Africans killed the captain and members of the crew, seized the ship, and demanded that the surviving crew sail them back to Africa. Instead, the crew continued west until the ship was seized by a U.S. revenue cutter off the coast of Long Island. The Africans were charged with murder and acquitted, but then several claims were made against them as property that was subject to salvage. Their case reached the U.S. Supreme Court, where they were defended by a team led by former President John Quincy Adams. The core of his argument would echo the language of our Declaration of Independence. The Africans were born free, and ever since have been, and still of right are, and ought to be free. The Supreme Court agreed, and on February 9, 1841, ruled that the men had been illegally held as slaves and were free. The 35 who were still alive at that point were returned to Africa as they had originally demanded. We'll have a link to that opinion in this week's show notes at hubhistory.com/019.
Friday is March 10th, which is the anniversary of 9 famous words spoken in a Boston lab. Alexander Graham Bell had a lifelong interest in speech and hearing. His mother and his wife were both hearing impaired, and he worked as an instructor at Boston's Horace Mann School for the Deaf. As a child, Bell had constructed an electrical device to reproduce crude speech, and he continued to refine that as an adult. By the 1870s, he was convinced that he could construct a device that would transmit understandable speech over a telegraph line to a faraway place where someone else could hear and understand it. After a desperate race to the patent office with another inventor, he was granted a patent for the method of and apparatus for transmitting vocal or other sounds telegraphically on March 7, 1876. On March 10th, Bell spoke into a diaphragm in one room in his lab, while his assistant Thomas Watson listened at a receiver in another room. A wire carried the famous words, "Mr. Watson, come here. I want to see you." The first words spoken by telephone.
The huge storm that rocked Boston on March 11, 1888, started off innocuously. It was a warm March day, and a light rain fell. But that evening, the rain changed to heavy snow, and the storm stalled off the coast. Up to 4 feet of snow fell, whipped by hurricane-force winds. In many places, drifts reached the second floor of houses, and some reports say that only chimneys were visible above the snow. In the days before reliable weather reports, people went off to work by streetcar in the morning, and then froze to death trying to walk home through the blizzard that evening. Many years later, a globe writer remembered. "I was there in person, a 5-year-old. I can recall flattening my nose against the window pane and wondering whether my father was going to make it. He did, but other dads were found dead in the deep drifts by rescue parties." As the storm dragged on, homes began to run out of food and coal. Towns were cut off as roads were closed and telegraph lines brought down. In Boston, there was so much snow that there was no place to put it. The city had to organize an army of workers to shovel the snow into carts, then take it out to the country to dump it.
Finally, Sunday is March 12th, and on March 12, 1761, an earthquake struck Boston. John Adams owned a book about the New England earthquake of 1755, and he made a note in a chapter about the source and cause of earthquakes. The book's author speculated, "It may be reasonably conjectured that the center or place in which earthquakes originate lies in some part of Canada or perhaps beyond it." Adams, excited that the British Empire had gained control of Canada from the French in the Seven Years' War, made a note in the margin just below that paragraph. March 12, 1761. Another earthquake happened, which may perhaps enable us to determine the whereabouts these earthquakes originate and what course they take. For, as all Canada now is in English hands, we may have accounts from Montreal, Quebec, and the several places upon the River St. Lawrence at what time this earthquake happened, its direction, and degree of violence. We'll have a link to John Adams' handwritten notes in the show notes this week at hubhistory.com/019.
John Adams had lived a very public life, as an attorney and later as a politician and diplomat. The subjects of our show today were seeking very different, very private lives. We'll start out with Mr. James Gately. Little is known about his early life, but Gately immigrated to the U.S. from Britain in 1847. He was born either in 1810 or 1805, and some accounts say that he was a wealthy, Eton-educated man who had been unlucky in love. After he arrived on our shores, he rented a small apartment in Roxbury. To support himself, he worked as a taxidermist and built elaborate bird cages. But this wasn't enough to make ends meet. Down on his luck, he spent untold hours working on one last amazing birdcage, a large one with ornate flourishes. But when it was complete, he was unable to sell it in Roxbury or Boston. He decided to try his luck in the neighboring town of Charlestown, so he packed up the birdcage, his dog, and $40 in gold coins and started walking. He was pickpocketed of his life savings somewhere in Cambridge, and upon arriving in Charlestown, was able to sell the cage for only a tiny fraction of what he thought it was worth. That was the last straw, and Gately decided that he'd had enough of people. He and his dog started walking south, and didn't stop until they felt that they'd left the city behind. In the independent town of Hyde Park, he found a patch of forest with a nice spring at a spot called Pine Garden Rock. He built a hut under a ledge of rock and supported himself by hunting the game that was common in rural Hyde Park in those days. Today, it's the corner of River Street and Huntington Avenue in our Hyde Park neighborhood, near the Mattapan Line. In the show notes this week, we'll include a link to an 1879 map of Hyde Park. If you can locate the corner of Huntington and River, you'll see the remains of the woods that attracted Gately.
Unfortunately, civilization eventually came to Pine Garden Rock. In that same 1879 map, you'll see that a paper mill has sprung up almost across the street from where Gately made his hut. I can't find an exact date for it, but at some point, as Gately got neighbors at Pine Garden Rock, he packed up and headed deeper into the wilds of Hyde Park. He was lucky enough to find his way to a tract of land called Grew's Woods. Henry Sturgis Grew was prominent in Boston society as a mill owner, banker, and philanthropist. He had inherited a summer estate in what had once been the far western fringe of Dorchester and was now part of Hyde Park, where he had a home and untold acres of forest. James Gately found his way to this forest, and he set up a 10-by-12-foot rustic cabin at a spot roughly on today's Hyde Park-Roslindale line. He would hunt and trap through the winter, both for food and as a source of the taxidermied curiosities he would offer for sale in the spring. Sources say that he would sell stuffed birds, rabbits, snakes, fish, and even frogs. He eventually built a small addition onto his cabin strictly to serve as a taxidermy studio, and there's an engraving of him at work that shows a small room packed to the ceiling with guns, tools, and stuffed birds of all sizes and species. He continued to build bird cages as well, though the record doesn't reveal whether he had better luck selling them from his hut in Hyde Park than he had had as a younger man in Roxbury, Boston, or Charlestown. Though Gately was squatting on his land, Henry Grew seems to have viewed him with a sense of bemused tolerance. Certainly Gately made no effort to hide his presence, and Grew made no effort to evict him. Gately, for a man who was seeking seclusion, seemed to have a fairly regular stream of visitors. An 1874 Boston Advertiser article described how he would hold court. He has a fine collection of birds and animals, and his fame in the vicinity has been such that he reaps a harvest from their exhibition to the many which seek his door. This strange man evidently has some property in England, for he has several times received remittances of money through the British consul, with presents of valuable dogs from the same source. Many ornithologists have visited Mr. Gately, and it's affirmed that in various works upon the subject, his views have been frequently entertained. There is a mysterious something which clouds the life of the hermit. He has excited much attention at different times, and many have evinced a strong desire to know the story of his life and the cause which has shut him up from the world for the past 27 years. Personally, I love the idea of a proper Englishman from the British consulate slogging through the woods to Gately's smelly cabin with a stack of cash or a rare wolfhound.
Gately passed away in solitude in his cabin in Grew's Woods on February 2, 1875. A few months later, the Boston Post carried this brief notice. The effects of the late James Gately, the hermit of Hyde Park, are to be sold at auction next Saturday. They consist of cabinets of birds and other curiosities. The Globe later reported that this auction yielded $1,700, and $400 was found sewn into the linings of his simple clothes. Treasure hunters became convinced that there was a buried treasure somewhere around Gately's cabin and dug up much of the surrounding woods, but nothing was ever found. Gately is buried in Dedham under a large stone marked simply Hermit. There's still solitude to be found in Grew's Woods, the legacy of which continues today in the DCR's Stony Brook Reservation, a 475-acre park that is the largest within the city limits of Boston. The woods there are home to a healthy population of deer and a growing coyote pack, as well as a pond full of fish and turtles. It and the neighboring George Wright Golf Course are an oasis in the city, but represent only a fraction of the forest that used to sustain the hermit Gately.
Where Gately tried to escape society by hiding himself in the woods, a woman named Anne Windsor Sherwin tried to find her solitude on Boston Harbor. Anne Windsor was born in Michigan in 1882, and at some point she moved to New York. In 1910, she married the playwright and actor Louis Sherwin, who was then working as the drama critic for the New York Times. They lived in Manhattan, and all seemed well at first, as they had three children together. Hollywood came calling for Louis in 1914, and he made it pretty clear that Hollywood hadn't mentioned his wife and children. He abandoned the family, and he moved out to the Los Angeles area. Louis became a scenarist, which is what we'd call a screenwriter today, for Samuel Golden Pictures, which would become part of MGM in later years. He has 7 writing credits on IMDb, and will include some promotional materials for his debut 1919 silent film, Bonds of Love, in this week's show notes. It seems to have opened to tepid reviews. Variety said, "Bonds of Love is at the Strand this week, and proved to be an acceptable and simple narrative of love for a man and child, set in the surroundings of a millionaire. What stories this Sherwin could write, if he would? Those who remember his clever, often brilliant contributions to local criticism can imagine. But let him start slowly. He has devised a story that any first-class exhibitor can buy with profit, particularly if he wants high-class patronage."
In the meantime, Anne and the children attempted to make their way on Long Island. Anne sold some short stories and worked as an interior decorator, but the money was far from sufficient. By 1922, the family was living in an abandoned mill building in Oyster Bay. They were broke, and the children were chronically absent from school. When Louis publicly announced his engagement to a young starlet, it brought media and law enforcement attention to Anne and her family. They were forced to flee Nassau County to avoid prosecution, and they wound up in Boston. Sometime between 1927 and 1930, Anne and her youngest child, William, took up housekeeping on the hulk of a 4-masted schooner called the Snettend that was moored in Federal Wharf in Boston Harbor. The Snettend had been built in Seattle in 1919 and was quickly refitted to ship coal and lumber up and down the East Coast.
Can we just take a minute to reflect on how weird it is that 4-masted schooners were still not only being used in the teens and 20s, but were still being manufactured? Tall ships seem like a relic in the age of armored battleships, but I guess they still served a very practical purpose.
Yes, though the Snettend was actually the last wooden schooner to be outfitted in Bath, Maine. She performed her duties until one ill-fated voyage in 1927. She was headed from Norfolk, Virginia to Bangor, Maine with a shipment of coal. Soon after leaving port, she was caught in a strong storm and had to be towed back to port to repair her masts and rigging. After 6 weeks of repair, she got underway again, but as she rounded Provincetown on the Cape, a bigger problem came to light. The load of coal in the Snettend's hold was on fire. 2 tugs and a Navy ship finally got the fire under control, but the Snettend had to be towed into Boston Harbor.
By early 1928, it was clear that repairs were a lost cause, and the ship was left to languish at a pier in East Boston. The record is a bit unclear as to whether the ship's owners invited Anne and William to move into the Snettend as night watchmen, or whether they simply squatted on her, as they had squatted in the Nassau County Mill Building. No matter how they came to be there, in 1936 the owners of the ship decided they wanted the Sherwins gone. They had decided to scuttle the ship, that is, to tow her to the outer harbor and deliberately sink her. They issued an eviction notice, which Anne and William defiantly refused to accept. In the show notes this week, we'll have a photo from news photographer Leslie Jones, snapped in January 1936, and captioned, "Anne Windsor and son William refused to leave the Hulk Snettend after eviction notice." The owners of the Snettend were thwarted by the Sherwins' refusal to leave, but they were also pretty sick of paying rent on that berth in East Boston. They decided to turn over title of the 245-foot-long ship to Anne Windsor Sherwin, but in doing so, they also towed the ship to a permanent mooring just off Castle Island. Despite this victory, the family's luck went south almost immediately. In a storm that winter, the Snetton was torn from its mooring and swept out to sea. Luckily, it ran hard aground on the shore of Spectacle Island.
Amazingly, Anne and William continued to live aboard the Snetton even after it was wrecked on Spectacle Island. A newspaper report described their littered living quarters and said that the Boston Police Department termed their situation indescribably unhealthy. They grew a garden on the deck of the ship and were treated as a curiosity by other vessels coming in and out of the harbor. The last chapter of the family's hermitage was written as World War II broke out and young William was drafted in 1943. Without her son, Anne Windsor Sherwin was unable to manage the solitary life on Boston Harbor. She had to move ashore, and the records last place her in Virginia in the early 1950s. The Snetton caught on fire in 1947 on the beach at Spectacle Island and burned pretty much to the waterline. In July 1951, she took her last voyage. Without sails, masts, or rigging, the hulk was towed out to the outer harbor by a single tug. The story of the Sherwins was well known, and curious onlookers watched from the beaches and pleasure craft. While the burned-out hulk didn't look like much, some onlookers noted the patch of flowers from Anne's garden that was still visible on deck. On July 21st, 1951, the Snetton was sunk in 190 feet of water. Today, the hull sits upright and intact, and it's a popular scuba diving destination.
If anyone wants to find out more about our two hermits, head on over to this week's show notes at hubhistory.com/019. We'll have a photo of James Gately posing outside his cabin in Grew's Woods, as well as an engraving of him at work on a taxidermy project. We'll link to that 1879 map of Hyde Park, an article that calls Gately a second Thoreau, and a picture of his simple headstone marked only Hermit. There's apparently a pamphlet titled A Sketch of the Life and Adventures of James Gately, the Hermit of Hyde Park, that was published in 1874, but I haven't been able to find a copy. If you have any leads, let me know. We'll also have pictures of Anne Windsor Sherwin and the ship Snetton that she called home. We'll link to a diving site where you can see contemporary photos of scuba divers exploring the shipwreck site.
If you want to get in touch with us, you can email us at podcast@hubhistory.com. We're at Hub History on Twitter and at facebook.com/hubhistory. Or you can go to hubhistory.com and click on the Contact Us link. And while you're on the site, hit the subscribe link and be sure that you never miss an episode.
That's all for now. We'll be back next time with the story of John Hancock and his private army in pre-revolutionary Boston.